In this COP27 interview with Dr. Sally Mulhaq, we discuss the arrival of loss and damage into the negotiations. We also discuss the need to urgently cut emissions in the wealthy nations that have caused the problem, and then across the world. Salim has been involved in the negotiations here since day one, so is well placed to discuss the function and dysfunction of the COP process. It's important to keep in mind that this is the only forum in the world where poorer, vulnerable nations have a seat at the table, even if, as he says, they're not often listened to. All this must change, and fast, if we are going to survive the onslaught of accelerating extreme climate impacts by fires, floods, and droughts. Here at the COP, in the wake of incredible, destructive flooding that took lives and destroyed heritage, the nation of Pakistan offers this portentous warning. What happened in Pakistan won't stay in Pakistan.
It's great to see you. This is COP27. After many years that I've been speaking to you, and you've always said it won't be this year, but it will be eventually. This was the eventually COP when loss and damage is inside the negotiations. Can you give me an overview of what have been the main features for you?
Well, I think the main breakthrough was the fact that climate change impacts have now started to happen visibly and attributably to the human-induced climate change. The floods in Pakistan, for example, the floods in Nigeria, hurricanes hit Florida. And so the reality is now overtaken and undeniable. And therefore, this being the 27th Conference of Parties is actually now the first Conference of Parties in the new era of impacts of climate change happening and losses and damages happening. So we're very pleased that we were able to get an agenda item on finance for loss and damage, something developing countries have been fighting for a long time without success. We were successful here at the beginning of the COP. We're grateful that all countries, nobody objected, all the countries agreed to adopt it. We've been having some very good discussions about that. It's now gone to the ministers' level. The minister from Germany, Jennifer Morgan, and the minister from Chile, Maisa, are in charge of talking to other ministers and trying to get a decision. We have great faith in them. They're both very committed and sympathetic ministers. And we now have two more days to go. I'm very optimistic that we will get the creation of a fund here. That's all we're asking for. We're asking that COP27, Sharm el-Sheikh, agrees to set up a fund for loss and damage. We call it a facility. Other people are calling it a fund. Doesn't really matter. But we agree to set it up. And then next year in COP28, we can work out the details. We won't be able to work out the details here. It's a lot of tough negotiations to go on the how it will function and how it will run. But at least a political decision to set it up should be done here, and we're hopeful that will happen.
Okay, and you're one of the people I think who's been instrumental in really driving this forward. So, I mean, credit for that. And Bangladesh is obviously a vulnerable nation now. You talked about Pakistan, and it just goes on and on and on. And there is a sense that even in the global north, we're not immune to this.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the other revelations that took place in the last year or so is that nobody's immune. The heat wave in Europe, the wildfires in California, the successive hurricanes that hit Florida in the United States, and the story goes on and on all over the world. So losses and damages due to impacts of human-induced climate change are now visible. You just have to watch your television screen every day and you'll see a new one happening somewhere in the world. And it's going to get worse, by the way. So it's not going to get better for the near term, at least. In the long run, we can help stop it getting very bad. But bad is locked in. It's going to get worse. And so we have to deal with it. And it's a global phenomenon. It's not just rich countries helping the poor countries anymore. It's everybody helping ourselves.
But what you are also doing is accumulating a huge amount of knowledge. And that knowledge also has global value, which we can't quite put into dollars or anything like that.
I think one of the important paradigm shifts that needs to take place and is beginning to take place is the notion that this is not just a rich versus poor. It's all countries are in it together. All countries need to work together. All countries need to collaborate together. And when it comes to dealing with the impacts of climate change, particularly floods, cyclones, hurricanes, the developed countries are not particularly better off than some of the poor countries like Bangladesh, for example, where we've been doing this for quite a long time and have a good record of doing it and capacity to do it. So the North can actually learn from the South here. The rich countries can learn from poorer countries on particularly tackling the impacts of climate change.
Okay, and I see you've got a badge there on your lapel, 1.5. Now, that's been a contentious issue at this COP. I've seen scientists and people who are part of the process speaking out quite angrily that as there have been efforts to kind of almost move away from 1.5. And have you heard the same things? Have you got a perspective on that?
Well, what is happening for certain is that staying below 1.5 becomes more and more difficult by the day. At the moment, we're headed to well over 2 degrees, possibly even as high as 2.8 degrees, unless we take drastic action, which we're not doing. And so the ability of the global community to stay below 1.5, which we've all promised to do collectively in the Paris Agreement, becomes more and more difficult by the day. And there is an attempt by some countries to try and give up on the goal. We certainly do not want to do that. The vulnerable developing countries want to stick to the goal. We all agree to do it. What we feel about delivering it is that we have the technology to deliver it. We have even the finance to deliver it. What we are lacking is political will by some of the big developed and developing countries who are the big emitters to actually make it happen at a very rapid rate. And so we need to accelerate the rate of reduction of greenhouse gases and consequently the use of renewables. Shift from fossil fuel to renewable energy is the big key global determinant.
We hear it a lot. It's a matter of political will, but really it's existential for many people. Mm-hmm. And I think even 1.5 is not exactly a nice place world to live in. I don't want to personally live in a 2 degrees world. I'm very afraid of that. So to say that we lack political will, surely now is the time for moderate people to get involved and say, we don't want to live in that.
Absolutely.
Because,
absolutely.
I mean, this is catastrophic. Yeah.
We certainly hope that citizens all over the world will now take the issue up and impress on their own leaders that this is something they have to take much more seriously than they have done. But the problem I feel for political leaders is it's a slow-moving emergency. It's not an immediate emergency, which you can see and respond to like the COVID-19 crisis was. And therefore, it's more difficult to raise the political will to deal with it. But unless we do, then we are heading for catastrophe, all countries, including the developed countries, yourselves. And hopefully they'll realize that and do something about it.
We've got a huge fossil fuel lobby in this COP. That seems pretty wrong to start with. Do you feel that if those lobbyists who are actually derailing the process or trying to, if they succeed, then when we start talking about loss and damage, okay, we're kind of committing us to a lot more loss and damage, so it makes it more realistic that it'll happen. But at the same time, we're committing to things we can't really adapt to. Now, how can we trust them to put money into a fund if they won't honour the things they agreed in Paris?
Well, I think, you know, we have to call out the fossil fuel industry as a whole. They have been undermining this process from the very beginning, and they've been able to do that with the help of a certain number of governments with whom they are in very close collusion. We need to call them out. They can no longer be given benefit of the doubt. They talk all greenwashing. They don't do anything. In fact, they try to prevent actions. So we need to be very, very firm about no more fossil fuels, no more investment in fossil fuels. In fact, we should be taxing them to get the money for the loss and damage, reparations and payment and liability to the victims of their pollution. They've been profiting by polluting, knowingly profiting that they were polluting, and they did it anyway. They need to be held to account.
And as the COP process moves forward, people from the global north in wealthy countries can also say, oh, you know, the COP's a load of rubbish. I don't want to go to the COP anymore. They never achieve anything. But people in the global south, they don't really have another forum to go and fight their case. I know you just outlined a vision. What could we do to make this so much more robust and effective and agile to meet the challenge?
So there are two aspects to this annual Jamboree event that we have every year. One of them is the core negotiations between countries. There are maybe a few thousand negotiators who come for that. And from our point of view, speaking now on behalf of the vulnerable countries, this is the only forum where we have a seat at the table to talk to the big guys. You know, in the Security Council, we don't have a seat. In the G7, we don't have a seat. Even in the G20, we don't have a seat. The UNFCCC is the only place where we have a seat at the table and can come and talk to them, hope to persuade them. Don't always win, but sometimes we do. Like we got the 1.5 degree in Paris. That was our doing. We persuaded everybody to agree to that. So it's the only forum where vulnerable countries have an opportunity to have a say and try and persuade everybody. Everything has to be by consensus agreement. So we cannot get an agreement if anybody disagrees. But nevertheless, we can do that. And then there's a second part of the COP, which has now grown to many tens of thousands. I hear we may be hitting 40,000 here in Sharm el-Sheikh. And those extra tens of thousands are not negotiators. They are people who come, and you'll see around here in the pavilions and the side events, scientists, youth groups, very active, NGOs, subnational governments like Scotland and others, many, many different groups having companies, many different companies, having meetings and talking about doing things. And I distinguish between the two COPs, the negotiating COP I call the talking COP, and they're still talking. We won't know what they talked about till the very end. And the action COP, which is where we're sitting right now here. There are thousands of people here who are talking to each other, working together. And the difference between the two is that in the talking COP, you need a consensus. Without consensus, you can't move forward. In the action COP, you don't need a consensus. All you need is allies. Anybody who wants to join can join and decide to do something. And there are many different what we call coalitions of action on forestry, on coal phase out, on adaptation, on loss and damage. Many of us are parts of these coalitions of action. And what we do here is meet with fellow activists or fellow scientists or fellow parliamentarians, big parliamentarians group, to take action together. To fulfill the commitments in the Paris Agreement. The way I see the Paris Agreement is that we needed governments to agree, which they did, but we don't need them alone to implement it. All of us can implement it. And what I see in the action COP here with the tens of thousands of people who are here in Sharm is the action part of the Paris Agreement. People are doing things. Not enough. We need to do a lot more, but we are not sitting idle. People are doing things, and that gives me hope.
Okay. But is there a risk, do you think, that sometimes there's a certain element of pomp to the COP? Do you think sometimes that can distract from those talks that are going on behind closed doors? Or do you think they add pressure to it? What's the relationship?
I think we add pressure to the talks going on behind closed doors. Certainly for the more democratic governments who have to listen to their citizens. And the other thing that we do get at the COP, and that's a positive, is we get a huge amount of media attention. The rest of the global media doesn't pay attention to this problem, except once a year there's a COP, they know about that, they come and they want to know what's happening. And I spend a lot of my time talking to the media, explaining to them what is loss and damage. It's a new subject. They don't understand it. They want it explained. So I try and do that. So we capture global attention, and we, the activists, are able to put pressure on the politicians to actually come out with a good decision as opposed to a bad decision.
Okay. I just want to come back to the loss and damage fund, because this is really significant if you get this mechanism, if you want to call it that. What sort of commitment, I know you're just looking, but say we go to next year and the year after, what's your trajectory, what's your vision for that?
So the good news is we have seen here in COP, even in the last few days, a whole set of countries step forward to offer funding. New Zealand, Belgium, Austria, Denmark, Germany. So there's about a dozen countries who have offered sums in the tens of millions, adding up to several hundred million, but they've offered them in separate tracks. So they will do stuff with that money. They said it'll be for loss and damage. What we are asking for here is a collective action, collective vision. All of us together, we agree to set up a fund and then have those commitments made to supporting that fund, which has a democratic governance structure where we can all decide what needs to be done with the fund. It will take a bit of time to work out that structure. How do we set it up? How do we run it? So we're not asking for that here. All we're asking for here is a political commitment to have such a fund. And then next year in COP28 in Dubai, we can come back with ideas on how to shape it, how to work on it, how much money would be needed, where the money might come from, and then who would be eligible to get the money. All very legitimate questions that we will need to grapple with and come up with answers for. But it shouldn't be too difficult to do that.
Do you think this kind of adds the importance of this holding to 1.5 and getting everybody to, it may look difficult, but radical change needs to happen if we're going to make this?
Absolutely. So the point we're making is that this is absolutely, the amount of loss and damage we suffer collectively around the world is absolutely linked to mitigation. 1.5 degrees is itself going to cause a lot of damage. At 1.1, we're already seeing damage. 1.51 will add more. 1.52 will add more. So every fraction counts. And we need to be holding it as much as possible to the 1.5 to prevent the huge losses and damages that we are now facing and we know we will continue to face. So it's not doing enough on the mitigation that will open us up to huge cost to pay on the loss and damage side. So to minimize that, we need to focus on the mitigation.
Okay. And this is, of course, an issue for everyone. So thank you very much.
Great speaking to you. Great. Good talking to you.